This podcast is brought to you by ClearBridge Investments. Meet an evolving economy confidently with ClearBridge Active Equities, the foundation of a resilient portfolio. ClearBridge, a Franklin Templeton company. Go to clearbridge.com to learn more.
Please stay tuned for important disclosure information at the conclusion of this episode.
Hi, and welcome to The Long View. I'm Jeff Patak, Global Director of Manager Research for Morningstar Research Services.
And I'm Christine Benz, Director of Personal Finance for Morningstar, Inc.
Our guest today in The Long View podcast is Rick Ferry. Rick is an hourly fee investment advisor at Ferry Investment Solutions. He's also a CFA charter holder. Prior to starting his new firm in April 2019, Rick was the founder and head of investing at a $1.5 billion advisory firm that specialized in low-fee asset management using index funds and ETFs. Rick is also the author of several books on low-fee investing, including All About Asset Allocation, the ETF book, All About Index Funds, and The Power of Passive Investing. Rick, thanks so much for being here today, and welcome to The Long View.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
So I wanted to get started. I think we're going to cover a lot of ground, but maybe we'll start on terra firma, so to speak, which is your advisory business, the services that you offer, the advice and planning services that you offer to your clients. And I know it's a multifaceted process, but one of the more important elements is asset allocation. And I was curious maybe to start with how the definition of value add has changed when it comes to investment and asset allocation services that advisors have delivered, if you could compare sort of the way it is you position the value that you would add in the confines of a broader plan today versus maybe how you would have positioned it 10, 15 years ago. I mean, would we notice marked differences?
I think you would notice differences. I probably spend a lot more time now really putting myself in the shoes of each client and probably spend almost an hour interviewing them on all different aspects of their life and their job and family. There is no one cookie cutter approach to asset allocation. I think that what I've learned in over 30 years of advising individuals is that everyone is unique. And I couldn't tell you when we opened up a conversation about your portfolio or Christine's portfolio or about any particular person, what their asset allocation would be at any time during their life, until we have a conversation about all the other things that go along with determining what an asset allocation should be. For instance, job security or income levels, inheritances, just a whole large range of different things that I find that I'm talking about with people for most of the conversations that I have with them. And then the conversation about asset allocation comes later, and the conversation about individual investments come even after that. So I think what I've learned is to take a lot more time getting to know the clients up front and spend a lot of time thinking about what might work best. Because, you know, the classic rules of thumb, such as your age and bonds, if you have nothing else to start with and you don't know anything else, that would be, I guess, a good place to begin. But as soon as you begin to get information from people, that changes dramatically one way or the other. So I think that's what I've learned about asset allocation over the years.
One convention that's emerged in terms of charging for services in the realm of financial advice is it seems that fee for service, whether a flat fee or an hourly fee, is the way a lot of people are charging for planning services. And then the investment advice piece is often charged based on the assets under management. You've approached this differently. You are providing investment guidance, but on an hourly basis. How did you arrive at that model for your new firm?
I've been through the whole gauntlet, if you will, of different fees. So I started out for the first 10 years in the brokerage industry, and you know that was transactional for the most part. And then I started my investment management company, and that was all AUM. And now I'm doing hourly. I see the fee question as expanding. Kind of put it this way, when index funds were first created in the 1970s and then expanded in the 80s and in the 90s, even more so, it didn't get rid of actively managed funds. When ETFs came out in 1994, I believe, and then expanded greatly a few years later, it didn't get rid of mutual funds, open-ended funds. It just added to it. And I think that these ways in which advisors are going to be charging more in the future. The flat fee, the hourly fee, a retainer, a subscription base are additive to what's already out there. I don't think that it's going to eliminate AUM. So, you know, it might flatline AUM. In other words, it might cause AUM to not grow, but I don't think it's going to eliminate advisors who are doing AUM. So it's just adding more variety and choices to individual investors as to how they want to pay for these services.
So related question, if in these early few months of your business, have you encountered clients or prospective clients where once you took a look at the situation, you said, well, what this person really needs first and foremost is planning advice, not so much the investment advice that I provide? Has that come up?
Oh, sure. It's come up a few times. And when that occurs, it's pretty clear to me that it's beyond my scope of services that I can offer them. So I will send them on to one of the networks and tell them, you know, that I can't really help you at this point. You need to get other help first, and then maybe later on come back to me.
If you're to contrast your current advice practice with what maybe you had done earlier in your career, how would you describe sort of the most salient differences between them, and maybe what were the triggers for you, the realizations that you had that I guess prompted you to make those choices about how you're going to set up your new practice?
Well, I set up my new practice hourly because I just thought that it was the best way to do the services that I was going to be doing for clients, which would be you hire me for a couple of hours or 3 hours to look at your portfolio to help organize it, and then you may not need me again because you're going to go implement it yourself. So when I looked at how best to charge for this, it was more how you would pay an attorney or how you would pay even a dentist, where you go in and you get the work done, you pay for the work, and then if you need more time or you need more work, you pay for that. And I thought that was the most fair way of charging for what I wanted to do. Now, what I've learned is that there was no doubt biases in every fee model. And when I was a transaction broker, I would go in at the beginning of each month and my screen would be blank. There would be a zero at the bottom, which means I had no money yet that month. And I had to build that number up by doing transactions or selling bonds, you know, selling stocks, getting fees in from various places that would come in from 12b-1 fees and whatever. And by the end of the month, I'd have a number. And oh gosh, I made my number. And the next month, it started at zero again. And that was that world. When I moved over to the AUM side, it was more steady. I knew that it was all based on how much money I had under management. So in thinking in my mind, when I'm meeting with a client, it was all, how am I going to get this client to do business with me? How am I going to get them to invest with me? How am I going to get them to put their assets with me? Because that's how I build up AUM, and that's how I built up my revenue. As a broker, it was all about, how am I going to do this transaction? How am I going to do that transaction? So now it switched over to assets was the focus, as opposed to the number of transactions. So broker was number of transactions, now assets under management, it was build the assets under management and collect fees. What is it now? Now it's simply hours. How many hours am I going to be able to, say, bill? And generally, I have a program where I only charge 2 hour, what I call a second opinion program, where I spend 2 hours with the client. I charge them $375 an hour, so basically $750 to go over their portfolio. And then we're done, and pretty much I write up a letter and tell them, here's what we talked about, here's your recommendation. But what I learned in that whole thing is that there are absolutely biases in each of these methods, these fee methods, where you feel it because this is your time. You have to make a living. And the incentives and how you get incentive, you make your money, what the incentives are, cause you to have biases in how you're going to react to a client situation. When I was a broker, there was no doubt that I was trying to push for transaction-oriented business, even if maybe the client didn't need it. When I was doing AUM, there was no doubt I was trying to get that client to transfer their money over to me, even though they might have been better off putting in a CD at a bank. So there was definitely incentives based on how I got paid. My recommendations to a client were based in part on the incentives that I got. Now, as hourly, if there are incentives there, it is much less of an incentive to try to get people to use me for 3 or 4 or 5 hours instead of just 2 hours. So I feel like the incentives, you know, under hourly, they might still be there, but they're much lower than the other models.
So one thing we sometimes hear from advisors who focus on investment portfolios is that they feel like they really earn their keep at kind of these market inflection points where investors might get freaked out when stocks are dropping and sell everything. So do you fear that with the hourly model, you'll miss out on some of those inflection points? You won't have that incentive to reach out to clients at those points.
Well, I'm not sure that at an inflection point, an advisor should reach out to a client anyway, because the client may not be worried and you just made them worried by reaching out to them. So there might be 1 or 2% or maybe 5% of clients who are worried, and generally they'll reach out to you, the advisor, as opposed to the other way around. What I've found in all my years is if it isn't broke, don't fix it. Just because the market went down doesn't mean you send a letter or an email out to clients and say, don't worry, everything's going to be fine. Just maintain your asset allocation and maintain your plan, and everything's going to be great. Because all of a sudden, you just took 95% of the clients who were not worried, and you made them worry. So I never really did that anyway. I bought into that. When a client was worried, they would let me know. And I think the same thing is going to happen with hourly. When a client becomes worried, they will let me know. So I know that advisors talk about how they add value behaviorally and all this stuff, but I think a lot of that is actually created by the advisor and not so much created by the client, in my opinion.
Maybe I wanted to shift gears and talk about, in an overarching sense, asset allocation again, if we may, and with a focus on accumulation. And my question for you is, do we think we have accumulation solved? I'm being a bit glib, but should advisors who are allocating their capital for those who are in accumulation phase, do you think they should view a low-cost target date fund series as their bogey? And do you think they could realistically best something like that?
I think a low-cost target date fund is fine, or a balanced fund like a Life Strategy fund is absolutely fine. It depends on the individual. Again, you'd have to have a conversation with each individual to find out what their ability to handle risk is. There are a lot of people out there who could be 100% equity. I talk with them a lot. They lived through the financial crisis, never sold one penny of stock. And they have a high tolerance for this because they don't really look at it. So again, the rules of thumb, which target date funds in many ways are based on rules of thumb, that as you get older, you have less in stock and you have more in bonds. When you really start talking with individuals about it, those rules of thumb go out the window and you can tailor something more to who they are as opposed to the average, if there is such thing as an average investor. I will say on the other side that there are some people who target date fund is actually more volatile than what they can stand. And so for those people, you know, having less in equity is what's right for them. So again, you're starting with what we all call the average, if you will, which goes into where you should be on a target date fund. But there are no average investors. Everybody sits on generally one side or the other. I'm not opposed to target date funds. I think they're absolutely wonderful. They're low cost. They do a great job in 401k plans to get people invested and out of cash. So I'm not opposed to it, but you know, somebody who's a little bit more sophisticated, has a little bit more experience, maybe the asset allocation in a target date fund might not be right for them.
Can you talk about maybe an example or two from your practice of a client where you felt like they were sort of an outlier in terms of asset allocation and needed some highly customized asset allocation prescription, maybe human capital considerations or extreme risk tolerance considerations?
What I found is that a lot of people I'm working with, and maybe the people I'm working with are a subgroup of the typical investor, the average investor, who we try to figure out who that average investor is, but they can handle more equity exposure and more risk than I think the models show. But there have been cases where people who are in their 30s would only probably be best off with maybe 40% in equity and no more, tend to be people who inherited their money as opposed to personally earned it. If somebody was to say to me, I'm 40 years old and I've got $2 million, that doesn't tell me anything about what their asset allocation should be. If they told me they're 30 years old and have $2 million and they earned it all themselves, well, that tells me something. Or if they are 30 years old and they have $2 million because they inherited it from their grandparents, that tells me something too. And not to pigeonhole people too much, but the person who inherited it from the grandparents is probably going to be much more conservative than the person who earned it themselves. And so there's no average investor, and I just can't get over saying that over and over again. There is no such thing as an average investor. Everybody is different, and the older we get towards, say, age 60, it seems to spread further and further and further apart. You just can't guess how somebody's going to be until you actually have an in-depth conversation with them.
This has been a wonderful decade for investors in U.S. stocks and bonds. As you know, the U.S. 60-40 portfolio has been a wrecking ball, so to speak. It's beaten nearly all comparable comers. So I was curious, what are the implications for the future in your view, and does that inform in any way how you allocate assets for clients that you serve? For instance, would you find yourself emphasizing foreign or smaller value or non-U.S. bonds a bit more than perhaps you would have at the outset of the decade?
I find myself advocating for the lowest fee funds I can possibly find and implementing the strategies in the most tax efficient way I can possibly do, because we need to squeak out every basis point from fees and every basis point we can from taxes, because the returns of the markets, just using a 10-year treasury right now, which might be 2.1%, and you just use that as a base, call it your risk-free return over 10 years, that's pretty low. And so going forward, if you know equities produce 3% over 10-year treasuries as a risk premium, you know, we're talking 5%, maybe 6%. So it's not going to be a lot there. Am I allocating more towards international? No. I've always maintained about a 30% position on the equity side. Am I allocating more towards factor investing? The answer to that is no, probably less towards factor investing. And I have been for a while because everybody's into factor investing, and I kind of believe there's a factor decay going on where there's a lot of weak hands in factor investing right now, which are causing the spreads, if you will, to be low. And until they leave the market, until all those renters, factor renters, leave the market, and factor owners are the only ones left, I don't see factor investing as giving us strong returns. It might, but I'm just trying to be as cheap as I can without making predictions about various parts of the market. So I'm moving more and more towards total stock market US, total international. If you're going to do some sort of a factor fund, do it as cheaply as possible using a Vanguard multi-factor fund or maybe one of the Goldman ETFs, to just do it as cheaply as you possibly can, because that's what's going to drive the incremental value in the portfolio later on. And on top of that, taking advantage of every opportunity you can to do backdoor Roth, mega Roth, whatever you can possibly do to take advantage of lowering your taxes is also going to add to your wealth later on down the road. And then when you go to distribute this money, do it in a very smart way, how you distribute it. Those are the things that are going to add value to a client's portfolio. It's not going to be whether or not I pick small cap value or emerging market allocated. That, I don't find that to be of use in many ways when I'm working with a client. What matters is living below your means, saving in a very tax efficient way, doing it as cheaply as you possibly can, and having the right allocation between equity and fixed income. Everything else is just icing on the cake. And a lot of it's just the glowing, sparkling candles on the cake that get blown out very quickly and don't mean anything. So you got to really concentrate on the cake and what you can do. And that's what I try to do.
Which factors strike you as particularly overcrowded today?
You know, I describe it this way, that you have an ocean and all of the studies of the factors are looking down on the ocean and saying, gee, the ocean seems, you know, normal. It seems like the ocean is like a typical ocean, right? So therefore, the factor premiums going forward should be like the factor premiums of the past. But the bottom line is underneath the currents that are going on in the marketplace. I find that we're not maybe measuring this stuff correctly. You know, we're measuring things based on simple price to book, price to earnings, you know, simple valuation metrics. We invest in a portfolio that's low price to book, or invest in a portfolio that's low price to earnings. I just feel like there's a lot more going on than just that. And I see all these funds coming out that are trying to get all these different exposures, all these different factors. And I see a lot of people going into those funds. And I read the data about how many institutions are going more and more towards factor investing and how many individuals are going more and more towards factor investing. I see that and I say, I'm not sure if that's being done for the right reasons. I mean, again, they seem to be a lot of factor renters rather than factor owners. And so there's something there that bothers me. And it's been bothering me for a long time. And it hasn't stopped bothering me yet, but for me to actually put my finger on what it is, I'm having some difficulty doing it.
So why would a multi-factor product then be more appealing? Or is it just simply the very low costs that come along with some of those products that you named?
Well, if I was going to do a factor fund, it would be a multi-factor fund only because I don't know which factor is going to actually give me a factor premium. So that's why I would do it. Rather than say, I want to buy a fund that has the momentum factor in it, and then I want to buy another fund that has a value factor, and then I want to buy another fund that has a quality factor, and then I want to buy a low vol fund. In other words, I have to buy four different funds, or I can just buy one multi-factor fund. Now, granted, some of these factors get a little pushed down when you're doing a multi-factor, but still, I would just buy one fund, and it would be a multi-factor fund, and I'd put it in a Roth account if I could, because I might love the fund today. Next year, I may not really like it. In 3 years, I may hate it. And in 4 years, I might want to divorce it. And if I do, I want it to be in a Roth rather than a taxable account.
So maybe to widen the aperture for a second, is there a checklist of sorts, mental or otherwise, that you're using when you're thinking about the eligibility of different asset classes for an allocation? You've talked before that you like to keep things simple, squeeze as much cost out as possible. But I have to think that you also have a framework or construct for determining whether or not a particular asset class would be a legitimate piece of the pie. So like, I mean, if we're to look at something exotic, right, like precious metals or
sure.
commodities managed futures, things that are potentially diversifying, do those have a role? And if not, why?
No, I don't use anything that doesn't have an expected real return in it. So if you take metals, there's no expected real return. Commodities, no expected real return. You might catch a trend, so you're doing trend following, and that might work. But again, I'm looking to fill a portfolio only with investments that have an expected real return, with the exception of cash. Cash is not going to have an expected real return, perhaps. So anything else other than that, gold, precious metals, commodities, cyber currencies, not right now, no.
And how did you say you determine expected real return for equities? I think I heard you describe the simple and sensible approach that you use for fixed income. But for equities, is there a buildup of sorts that you're doing to form some expectations about what real returns can be expected?
For sure. So you have a long-term equity risk premium that it is in the marketplace, and it's generally about 3% over corporate bonds. I think I did this study one time. I went back, I don't know, all the way back to the 1700s, and I find some data. Maybe it was even before that. But I found that equity returns over borrowing costs of companies were about a 3% premium. So if we look at where an intermediate-term corporate bond fund would be today, let's say the Vanguard Intermediate-Term Corporate Bond Fund, you know, it's around 3.5%. You add 3% to that, you're at 6.5. So that's one way of getting to a 6.5% expected return from equity. You could also build it up from what is inflation, what is dividends, what is GDP per capita growth, and you can get to the same 6.5 that way as well. So various ways. Now, do valuations matter? In other words, if the market was 35 times earnings right now, yeah, valuations do matter. So I have to take off what expectation there is of PEs expanding or contracting. You know, at this point, we're probably sitting at 18 times earnings for this year. That's slightly high, but not very high given 2.1% 10-year treasury. So, you know, it's not preventing me from telling people, you know, let's go ahead and just get the money in and don't bother dollar cost averaging. Let's just get it in. Now, if the market was at 35 times earnings like it was back in early 2000, I was hesitant. I would be telling people, let's dollar cost average in. So those are really the only factors that play into my decision when working with somebody as to, you know, when to get money into the market or maybe when to do a reallocation out of the market because they desire to have less equity at some point. And what's the valuation of the market? Is it at the beginning of 2009 where it's way down? At that point, I would say, let's hold off doing a rebalancing out of equity. You didn't really have to rebalance. The market was already there. But, these are the only reasons I would use valuation.
You talked about how increasingly you're gravitating toward the total market trackers. Within equities, I think that that's pretty clear what you're talking about. How about within fixed income? What does the fixed income sleeve of client portfolios look like?
Yeah, so that's a good question because the total bond market index fund is constantly shifting as far as the allocations between corporates and treasuries and mortgages. It depends on how much money a client has. If there's enough money there to split that up between treasury index, intermediate term corporate index, maybe TIPS, I do that often. So the total bond market index fund is okay, but it does shift around a lot as far as its allocations, and the duration changes a lot. So as interest rates go down, duration expands, and I'd rather have a little bit more control over it by splitting it up and keeping it at a more of a fixed duration.
Do you use individual bonds?
There's nothing wrong with using a bond ladder. A lot of people come to me, they have I bonds. That's perfectly fine. They want to do certificates of deposit and do a bond ladder. That's perfectly fine. Sure. But I don't do corporate bonds where there needs to be some sort of a credit analysis. Municipal bonds are tougher, although they do have something out there now called bullet shares, where you could do a bond ladder using bullet shares. It's a little more expensive than buying individual munis, but at least you get diversification.
I think you've expressed misgivings, if I'm not mistaken, about bond ETFs in the past. And so I wanted to drill down a little bit there and see if you can update us on your views. Have you come to feel a bit more confident in the way bond ETFs function, where you're committing client capital to those, or do you still prefer individual bonds and bond mutual funds?
No, there were some areas of the bond market where mutual funds were not the best option. Let me put this, index funds were not the best option, but it's changed. Things have changed. The ETFs have gotten a lot better. Municipal bond ETFs have gotten a lot better. So there was a period of time when I would say, don't buy the MUB ETF, the municipal bond ETF. This is, again, maybe 10 years ago, because there's not a lot of municipal bonds in there. What you want to buy is you want to buy the Vanguard Intermediate Term Municipal Bond Fund, even though it's an active fund, because there's 3,000 bonds in there. So I would tell people that. And the same thing with corporate bonds, you know. Years ago, LQD only had 100 corporate bonds in it. So I would tell people, we're not going to buy LQD. We're going to buy something that has, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of corporate bonds in it. So that was my issue. Well, now things have gotten a lot better. MUB has thousands of municipal bonds in it. LQD has thousands of corporate bonds in it. So in other words, the way in which ETFs are being managed, they have permanent bonds in there, and the way they're doing custom creations and redemptions now, it's just being managed a lot better, but it wasn't that way originally. So this is why I had some issues when these indexes first came out, but now they're better.
Are you at all compelled by Vanguard and other parties' research on the diversification benefit afforded by international bonds, like a hedged international bond product?
I've never been a big fan of international bonds, hedged or unhedged. I don't think that it's necessary in a U.S. investor's portfolio. There are thousands upon thousands of bonds you can buy that are U.S. denominated. And even if you bought a total bond market index fund, 8% of that is in Yankee bonds, which are already foreign bonds that are issued here in the U.S., only they're issued in U.S. dollars, so you don't have that extra cost of currency hedging. So I'm not a big fan of international bonds. However, I'm not negative on them. In other words, if somebody was to say, I have this in my portfolio and I want to keep it, my answer would be, that's fine. I have no issue with you keeping it. But if you came to me all with cash, I wouldn't have bought it. So that's how I feel about international bonds. And I've felt that way for a long time. I know that Vanguard came out with this international bond fund. I'm not exactly 100% convinced everything Vanguard does, they do it because they think it's a good idea. I think they do a lot of this because their investors want it, and that's why they do it, because they would rather offer it to their investors at a low fee than the investor go out somewhere else and get it at a high fee. But I'm not 100% convinced that everything they come out with is something that they want.
Maybe if we can continue sort of our round robin of different asset allocations in different component pieces of that, I think that REITs are something that have actually figured into asset allocation models that perhaps you've written about previously. And so maybe wondered if you could update us on your views, whether investors should consider having a dedicated allocation there, even though they're picking that up perhaps through their total U.S. market exposure. Do you think that REITs are still, you know, a pretty pivotal part of a diversified asset allocation?
I don't think they're pivotal. It's the icing on the cake. I have something called a Core 4 portfolio, which is one of the Core 4 portfolios, are U.S. total stock market, international total stock market, total bond market, and then a small slice of REITs. it's the fourth asset class. In other words, it's the icing on the cake, if not just the sprinkles on the icing on the cake. It's not a big deal to have a little bit of REITs in the portfolio. That being said, real estate is a huge part of our economy that's not captured in the stock market per se. There's only about 3% of the capitalization of the commercial real estate market that's actually in the stock market. And if you look at GDP, that should be probably closer to 13%. So if you wanted to get your portfolio to look more like the economy as opposed to the stock market, then having some more real estate through property REITs is one way of doing it. And another way of doing it, by the way, is having a small cap value fund in there, which tends to emulate the returns of private equity. But it's not necessary. But if somebody has it in there already, that's fine. If they don't and you want to put a little icing on the cake and put 10% of your equity exposure in REITs, that's fine too. In the long run, it has helped. I don't know if it's going to continue to help going forward, but it has helped in the past.
Would the client's direct real estate ownership interests have any bearing on whether you would recommend a REIT allocation? So if someone had multiple properties, for example, or had rental properties?
Absolutely. I generally wouldn't recommend REITs because they're already exposed to real estate. Now, if a client comes to me and they have rental properties, if they have other direct real estate, that is their extra real estate holding a portfolio. I don't generally put them in REITs. Or if we did, it wouldn't be as much because they already have exposure to the real estate market. Again, it's not a really important asset class to have in a portfolio, so you can skip it anyway. But if they already have rental properties on top of that, or they already have private real estate, then it really becomes unnecessary to have a REIT ETF or a REIT index fund. If I was going to put a real estate fund in a portfolio, it would normally go in the Roth if it's available, even though the new tax laws have made it a little bit better to have it in a taxable account. It is still better off in a Roth account if you can get it in there.
So we've talked about accumulation. Perhaps it makes sense to spend some time talking about deaccumulation spending. And we know that there's no single right answer to how one approaches spending, supporting a particular income. But is there a construct or a process that you follow in trying to build portfolios or allocations that you think are especially well suited to deaccumulation spending needs?
Great question. Now, here is where everything becomes very individual. You know, when do you retire? When are you going to take Social Security? Even how you're paying for health care. It becomes so individualized. How much money do you have inside your retirement plan? Are you going to be required to take some money out to live off of that? Or do you have enough money outside your retirement plan where you could wait till age 70 to begin to withdraw from your IRA accounts? Should you do a Roth conversion early on? There are so many variables that go into what is the best thing for a particular client. One of the things that I'm finding is that the software doesn't seem to be very good at this. And you really have to give a lot of thought to how you want to spend down your money. So one of the things that I've been doing is I've been using the concept that I think Michael Kitsis, Wayne Fowd, and other people have been talking about. You might go to a more conservative allocation in your taxable account when you retire, and then you start selling off your bonds to live on and not take Social Security because Social Security is building like a bond. So the present value is building there on one side. And on the other side, you're selling off your bond portfolio in your taxable account. And I don't rebalance. Another thing I'm not doing anymore. People start with an asset allocation in retirement. I'm not rebalancing them anymore. I don't even recommend they rebalance. So there's an awful lot that goes into where the client is going to get the cash flow that they need in retirement and all the different sources they get. And we talked about real estate. Sometimes there's real estate involved. Sometimes there's an inheritance involved. So this is probably the hardest part of coming up with what's the right allocation, what's the right decumulation asset allocation, where to have your assets located, your equities and your fixed income. It might be more equity in your retirement accounts when you're accumulating, and then you want to get those equities over to the taxable account when you're decumulating and get the bonds into your retirement accounts. A whole lot goes on during that period of time, and it's all very, very specific to each individual client. There's just no rules of thumb that cover this.
So you mentioned you don't rebalance for retirees. It always strikes me that rebalancing proceeds would be a tremendous source of cash flow for retirees, especially right now, for example, where you've got enlarged equity weightings and retirees who are looking at bond yields of 2%+. Wouldn't selling some equities be a logical place to go if you want to kind of set someone up with cash flows for the next couple of years?
Well, there's another way of looking at it. When you sell equity, you have to pay capital gains. So if you just sell bonds on the taxable side until you hit Social Security, then you don't have any capital gains. I tell people in their taxable account, you want to own equities that you will never sell your rest of your life, because that's the goal. Don't ever sell it. Don't ever sell your total stock market index fund. Don't ever sell your total international fund. If you're going to do any kind of rebalancing and there's equities in your retirement account, sell them there, do the rebalancing there. Don't sell it in your personal account, because you will be creating tax consequences if you do it. And, you know, with the tax code, with the capital gains being put up on top of everything else, you end up having to pay more in Medicare. You end up having a lot of things happen when you start taking capital gains in a taxable account when you're retired. So if you don't take capital gains by selling stock in a taxable account, you just sell the bond side until you get Social Security, and then you get the income from the Social Security to replace the money from the bonds. And whatever rebalancing you're going to do, you do it in your IRA account. It's a better way of doing it, or even doing it in a Roth, although I'd like to see the Roth continue to grow with equity. So it's a different way, it's a different mindset of how you're going to do decumulation. A lot of it's all based on taxes. This idea that you have to reduce risk as you get older doesn't make sense for a lot of people. It certainly doesn't make sense for a lot of the clients that I work with, because they're never going to use that money. This money is going to go to the children and to the grandchildren. So why not go at a stepped up basis 20 years down the road? Why not leave it in total stock, total bond, let it accumulate, and 20 years down the road, it goes to them on a stepped-up basis. You've avoided all tax. So there's a lot of things to think about here. And again, I would approach somebody who has a couple of $100,000 for retirement and just barely making it differently than somebody who's got $4 or $5 or $6 or $10 million, and they're only needing $150,000 a year. It's very specific to each individual client. There is no one-size-fits-all. There's a lot of moving parts. And I think that this whole idea of decumulation and distributions are all being, you know, rehashed again, because it seems to be there are better ways of doing it than the classic way in which we've been taught.
You mentioned Michael Kitsis and Wade Fow, and that made me think of their reverse glide path research. And it seems like if there were ever a time for an asset allocation framework like that, it might be right now, where new retirees, I think, confront sequence of return risk full on at this time. What do you think of that research? Is that something that you've incorporated into your clients' portfolios who are approaching retirement?
Yeah, so I wrote a piece, interestingly, about the same time they were coming out with their piece, and it was called The Center of Gravity for Retirees. And I basically said, when you're going to retire, you start thinking along the lines of having a minimum 30% equity allocation and then going up from there. And so when Wade Fowden and Michael Kitsis came out with their research, where it was this reverse glide path, I asked Wade, I said, well, what asset allocation were you starting with? And he ironically said 30%. Which was the exact point I was starting with. So I do believe in that. From an estate planning standpoint, from a family wealth standpoint, to allow your equities in your taxable account to grow untouched, not rebalanced, just let them grow, is the best thing for the estate in the long term. And if you're not going to need the money anyway, dividends increase. So you've got this equity that's growing, you've got dividends that are increasing, thereby creating more cash flow that you can live on. Again, it's a completely different way of thinking about asset allocation in retirement. But for some people, depending on the wealth that they have, and if they're never going to touch a certain amount of equity, having that in a taxable account and letting it grow is the best tax advantage that you could get, unless it was in a Roth. You know, you're limited to how much you have in a Roth. So again, it's just a different way of thinking about things. And I've been using it a lot with my clients. And, you know, a lot of them are high net worth, so it works for them.
I want to ask what you think of the bucket approach to retirement portfolio allocation. Don't worry about hurting my feelings.
I have to remember. I have to remember what. I think we're all talking about the same thing, Christine. We really are. My buckets might be a little bit different than your buckets, but I think we're all kind of talking about the same thing. I have my equities producing cash flow, which goes into the cash that I live on. The bonds get, instead of the cash going into the bond bucket, if you will, the cash goes into your pocket from the dividends of the stock that you live on.
and the bonds, you know, eventually whittle down as you need more money. I think we're all talking about the same thing. It's just maybe the size and the shape might be different.
Maybe if we could shift gears briefly and talk about indexing, which is a topic that you've written on extensively, as we know. And I'm curious whether, you know, direct indexing or indexing 2.0, this is another term that I think Michael Kitsis has popularized, this notion that ETF providers, even mutual fund, indexing mutual fund providers will be disintermediated and investors don't send directly own sort of personalized baskets of stocks that maybe or maybe not conform to an index. What's your view on that? Do you think that's a real thing and will be a big part of our investing future?
Well, of course, it's been around forever. Parametrics have been doing this for, God, it must be at least 30 years now. I remember when I came in the industry 30 years ago, Parametrics was doing this. So, you know, this idea of buying all 500 S&P 500 stocks and selling off the losers and generating some capital losses, it works great for a while, but there's no end game to it. You end up with a portfolio of 500 low-cost basis stocks and management fees to manage it, and then it gets bought out. Well, nothing you can do about that. Guess what happens? You get a big capital gain distribution. So in other words, the other side of it, it may sound good at the beginning, the front end, the first 5 years or even 10 years, but the next 10 years not so good, and the third 10 years really bad. Now, potentially, the way to solve that is to figure out a way, somebody who's smarter than me, figure out a way of taking that end basket of 500 stocks that is now all low cost basis, somehow, some way, turn it into an ETF provider and get issued shares of the S&P 500 fund, like IVV or SPY or something. And so now you only have one security, and that cost basis of that security is your total aggregate cost basis of the stocks that you turned in. If that happened, if these direct indexing companies could somehow figure out that, how to get around the regulations that don't allow that, if that's the end game, then I would love direct indexing. But until we get to that end game, the second 10 years and the third 10 years don't look really pretty to me. And you end up at a really lot of securities in a portfolio and always fees for somebody to oversee it, and eventually taxes as these companies get bought out or merged. Where if it was in an ETF wrapper at the end, if somehow you could get it into an ETF wrapper, boy, that would be wonderful. But I don't think anybody's figured that out yet.
There are thousands of ETFs, but the assets are increasingly concentrated in very few funds, some of the core funds that you've talked about. Do you see that that's a problem in any way? And what, if anything, would be the catalyst to change the fact that we've seen flows going to such a small number of products?
Well, the mutual fund industry has always launched new product every single year, and new product has closed because there's no interest or poor performance. And, you know, the same thing is happening in the ETF industry. So as the ETF providers, fund sponsors launch these things, you know, like throwing jello at a wall, right? Some of it sticks, some of it doesn't. And what doesn't stick falls to the floor. They clean it up and they throw some more jello at the wall. So I don't see it as a problem because it's always been going on in the mutual fund industry. In fact, it's always been going on in the ETF industry, just not as long, and will continue to go on. But I don't see it as a problem. If you do buy one of those very niche funds that doesn't have a lot of money in it, and it does close down, I think within 5 business days, you end up getting your money back, but you end up having to pay capital gains on anything that's in there. That's a small problem. But it's not something that I personally, you know, recommend to people, that they buy these niche ETFs.
What about the growth of indexing? The late Vanguard founder, Jack Bogle, had sounded some alarms, albeit constructively, about the growth of indexing and what that might portend for the future. Do you share any of those concerns? Do you feel like we can get to a point where indexing, for reasons of governance, call it antitrust, what have you, can be too large or can create some structural imbalances that would be of concern to the markets more generally?
I don't see it as a big of a threat as other people. Vanguard is not colluding with State Street, and they're not colluding with Schwab, and they're not all colluding together as far as voting these proxies. And every single one of them has a requirement to do what's in the best interest of their shareholders. So I don't see it as an impending problem that maybe some others do.
Speaking of Vanguard, we lost our friend and mentor, Jack Bogle, earlier this year. Can you reflect on Jack's influence on your career trajectory?
Sure. I mean, he changed my life, changed my career. When I read his book, Bogle on Mutual Funds, in 1996, I was having a real moral dilemma working in the brokerage industry. I was seeing poor performance by a lot of the money managers that we were using. I couldn't figure out how to fix it. I was really not happy working in the industry. It'd been about 6 or 7 years, and I was considering leaving the industry. I read his book. He was just speaking right to me. You know, there are other people out there who feel just like you do, and the problem is not your problem. The problem is a problem with the industry. And I said, wow, this is what I have to do. This is my calling. I have to follow this. And, you know, when I turned and I tried to do that actually at the company I was working for at the time, but they would have nothing of it, brokerage firm. I planned my escape then from Wall Street, and I started my own company in 1999, not expecting for it to be very big. I was just going to have a little practice where I had, you know, 100 clients. And the next thing you know, I guess I was in the front of the wave. And, you know, I charged a very reasonable fee of 0.25% to manage portfolios. I thought that was fair. And just exploded right at the beginning. So, I mean, it just changed my life. And he spoke his mind. He was a great man. He was right on just about everything he said. And, you know, he will be sorely missed, but, you know, I'm making it my goal to make sure that everybody continues to remember who he is.
Well, Rick, it's been our great pleasure to have you on the Longview podcast. Thank you so much for your time and insights. We really enjoyed having the opportunity to speak to you today.
Yeah, thanks, Rick.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks for joining us on the Longview. If you liked what you heard, please subscribe to and rate The Longview for Morningstar on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You can follow us on Twitter at Christine_Benz.
And at SYouth1, which is SYOUTH and the number 1. Finally, we'd love to get your feedback. If you have a comment or a guest idea, please email us at thelongview@morningstar.com. Until next time, thanks for joining us.
This recording is for informational purposes only and should not be considered investment advice. Opinions expressed are as of the date of recording. Such opinions are subject to change. The views and opinions of guests on this program are not necessarily those of Morningstar Inc. and its affiliates. Morningstar and its affiliates are not affiliated with this guest or his or her business affiliates unless otherwise stated. Morningstar does not guarantee the accuracy or the completeness of the data presented herein. Jeff Batak is an employee of Morningstar Research Services, LLC. Morningstar Research Services is a subsidiary of Morningstar Inc. and is registered with and governed by the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. Morningstar Research Services shall not be responsible for any trading decisions, damages, or other losses resulting from or related to the information, data analyses, or opinions, or their use. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results. All investments are subject to investment risk, including possible loss of principal. Individuals should seriously consider if an investment is suitable for them by referencing their own financial position, investment objectives, and risk profile before making any investment decision.